Everybody on Human Services and Early Childhood will come to order. Welcome, everyone. We've got a number of things to take care of today. We're going to go through our public hearings first. I do just want to, on the record, there's an error in the amendment to Senate Bill 659 that DHS noticed, so we are going to carry that over to Thursday so we can get that correction. Do I have to open the work session to carry
it
over?
You should hit the gavel.
Okay. So I'm going to open the work session on Senate Bill 659, carry Senate Bill 659 over to Thursday, and I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 659. And we have Representative Stark here, so we are going to open with Senate Bill 741. Cheyenne.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 741 requires the Department of Human Services rules governing home studies and placement reports in adoption proceedings give equal status and priority to relatives and current caretakers as is given to prospective adoptive parents with regard to child safety, attachment, and well-being, and to prefer relatives and current caretakers over other persons with regard to suitability. Requires a report to the court when adoption agency has removed or plans to remove a child to another placement who has been in a foster home for a year or pursuant to a permanent foster agreement.
Thank you. Representative Stark, welcome to our committee, and thank you for bringing forward this incredibly important bill. I'm especially excited about this hearing today.
Thank you for having me. For the record, my name is...
And Senator Olson, thank you for bringing forward this incredibly important bill. I'm really looking forward to this hearing today.
All right, we'll try that again. Good afternoon. My name is Dwayne Stark. For the record, I am a representative for House District 4 in Southern Oregon, which includes Eagle Point, Central Point, White City, Gold Hill, Rogue River, and the south part of Josephine County. And so today I'm actually here, even though I am a legislator here in the building, I'm here to actually tell my personal story. And I've been told that it's more effective in human services committees, and given that I'm a vice chair on the other side of one of these, to show you pictures. But I only have a little one, so I'm going to carry it up. Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Sure.
It's your discretion,
okay with me.
Chair.
Really?
So it's your house. These
are the two boys that I'm talking about. The ones in orange. She's got big, nice pictures.
The boys in
mine
orange.
Are little.
So before I get going on my story, I do want to clarify something that my story is not a criticism in any way of the Department of Human Services. Okay, and in fact, the ultimate, you know, we're coming up on Thursday will be the 1 year anniversary of these two brothers coming into my home. And so my criticism is about a policy that we passed, or the legislature passed, without me being here many years ago. That I think went further than they intended to go. And so if at any point it sounds like I'm criticizing the DHS, that is not my intent. My intent is to allow us to change our rules or our laws to allow them to function in a way that is better suited for the children. So this bill is about, and you'll hear a little bit more history and some of the ins and outs on this bill from, you know, the pros from Youth Rights Justice here in a few minutes and more in-depth history than what I have. But I've actually had the opportunity to experience a portion of this bill as far as the one-year permanency that we'll be talking about in a minute. I've actually been on both ends of the spectrum with that. Okay, if you saw the oldest girl in that picture, I was able to adopt her after 6 months of her being with my family. And at that time, this was around 2007, at that time the system or the laws were designed in a way that really favored foster parents and sometimes to the detriment of family and that family bond. We all know that blood runs deep. And so some well-intended individuals who will come up today and talk about, you know, their emphasis back in the day, attempted to change that so that it balanced out and actually made sure that people were considering family as long-term placements for children. Now, I do also want to point out that as I talk about placement, I'm talking about once parental rights are terminated, and a child comes up for adoption. So when I talk about their permanent placement, I'm not saying over mother or father. I'm saying extended family versus foster parents and so forth. So, and I believe it was 2007, and somebody will probably correct me on that date here in a couple minutes, that they decided they really wanted to make sure that family was considered. And that's important, and research has shown that that's important. But I believe that the pendulum swung much further than they intended to, and that we need to correct that moving forward with this bill. So how it plays out is these two boys, and by the way, I actually have permission, I've received permission on several occasions from the mother of these boys to share this story. And she said, by all means, please do. So how it plays out right now is a foster family brings children into their home. And I brought these boys in, and knowing full well that if there was family, that family always trumps. When it comes to adoption, the law is family always trumps foster parents. And the DHS let me know from the beginning that if anyone in the family, any extended family at any point decided that they wanted to be involved in an adoption process, that they would trump my wife and I as the opportunity to adopt these two boys. So what was interesting is about 3 months into having these children, the mom called us up, and we built a really good relationship with her. We still have a good relationship with her. And she called us up and she said, hey, would you consider adopting my boys? She was pleased with our work with these boys, and she said that given some life situations and some health statuses of hers that she was going through, that she felt like she would not be able to get to a point where she'd be able to get them back. And so she said, would you please adopt them? And we said, we would love to. Okay, our commitment to children when they come into our house is whether it's 4 hours or forever, we're committed to them. And so we were open to that, and we said, but that's not how it works. And so when the mom was informed that extended family would be granted preference over us, she decided just to keep that from happening, that she would fight this and attempt to get them back with full knowledge that that she felt like she wasn't going to be able to succeed in that. So DHS started doing their extended relative searches that they're required to do based on our laws, and they came up with a great uncle in Texas, a great uncle who had not spoken to these boys' mom in a decade or more and had no idea that these boys existed. This great uncle, he may be a wonderful, wonderful man, but he's in his later 50s and has no other children at home. And I say that because attachments are important. And so as we move forward, we take a look at this situation. We're saying, okay, here we're coming up on a year of these boys being part of my family. If you look at the boys and girls standing next to them, these two boys in the middle in that picture, they call the other boys and girls in that picture brother and sister. They call my wife and I mom and dad. And they know they have another mom, and they see her regularly, and we're open to that. And what's interesting is one of these boys also has some special circumstances. He has some cognitive challenges, so some learning challenges, and he also has some attachment disorders, which just makes sense. He's bounced from one home to another and so forth. Interestingly, my wife and I are both trained specialists in that area. My wife is a licensed clinical social worker who specializes in working with children. I have history in working with children who are at risk and very difficult cases. So we are well trained for these boys. And it's been heartbreaking all along to be told that even though we're coming up on 1 year and we're 2 years away from 1 year, we are told that we will not be considered, no matter what, if there is blood. If there is any sort of blood that these children could go to, we won't be considered. And that just doesn't make sense. Okay, what makes sense is to do what it is in the best interest of the children. And so this bill is not about giving my family, and again, I really am at peace. My wife and I have spent a lot of time praying through this issue. We're at peace with the ultimate outcome of where these boys may or may not go. It's yet to be determined. There's some other factors that have come into play that we're looking into. But just the policy itself, to be told, regardless of who we are, that we're not considered. And we're sitting here going, hey, if you want to do what's in the best interest of children, then recognize that after a significant amount of time, like a year, that there are significant attachments, and at least allow an adoption committee to consider the foster family. We're not saying to place them over blood relatives. We're not saying to do that. We're saying just give them a fair shot and actually look and go before the committee and say, what makes more sense? The parents that have been raising these children for a year and the siblings that know and love them and call them brother and sister and have specialized trainings to meet their unique needs? Or senior relatives that didn't know they existed prior to a couple months ago? And allow a committee to make that decision on a fair basis and to say what is in the best interest. And there will be times where it's not as lopsided as the story I'm giving you. And there will be times where foster parents are brought forward and they'll still choose the family because that is a significant, blood runs deep. And we're not denying that. All we're saying is give children a chance, give foster parents a chance to be considered. That's the point of this bill. That's the main goal in this bill. There's another part about judge placements that they'll talk about. Now, as I started into conversations about this bill, and there's kind of an interesting story that I can tell you offline someday about when Youth Rights Justice first came to talk to me about this, but I was informed that there's supposed to be a policy in place that would allow a foster parent to petition to come before the committee. And I would argue that the counties don't all acknowledge that policy if it exists. And I'm going to have my constituent, Denise Loredich, share with you here in just a moment her story and how tragic that this has been and how that policy, if it exists, is not normally followed. And therefore, we need to kind of change it so it's clear that, yes, we can consider foster parents. So thank you for your patience with me as I told a long and elaborate story. And I'd like to turn it over to my constituent here.
Thank you. My name, first of all, is Denise Loredich. I'm a foster mom in Josephine County. And I just want to, first of all, say thank you for allowing me to speak on the behalf of so many families that have went through this and are currently going through this, as I have been told. So my story is a little bit different than Representative Stark's. We got Lily at 2 days old. She came into our home. When she was placed in our home, we were told that there was no family that wanted her. Her parents would most likely not get her back, and that we would be long-term placements for her. We were told from the very beginning that at the one-year mark, if there was no family that had stepped forward, at that one-year mark, we would move into a status that would put us able to adopt Lily. We were told that by three different caseworkers throughout the year. At 13 months, when we went to court to change to from return to parent back to or to adoption, her case got switched to yet another caseworker, so now she's had four. And when that caseworker came out to visit us right after it had turned to adoption, she said, "I'm sorry that you've been told all that. You don't get to be considered. There is a family that has come up, and now they want Lily." So this was devastating to our family. It was, I wanted answers. I wanted to know why I was told so many times that this was the case, and now it's been ripped out from under us. What can I do? Where can I go? Now, mind you, I had also asked in the beginning, what is my responsibilities? Where is my limitations as far as bringing Lily's parents and grandparents into her life? I mean, what can I do? And they said, well, just do what you're comfortable with. Given my background, I'm very comfortable with bringing Lily's family into our lives and making them a part of her life. And as she knows it, she has a mom and a dad. And she has a mom and a dad, me and my husband. I have flown her to New Mexico to spend time with her grandparents. I have completely involved them and her in their lives. I have shared the love and the joy of this child with them greatly. And Lily's mama, even though she has some mental issues and she cannot care for her child, and she's already lost one to the state of California. She loves her babies, and she deserves to be able to be a part of their life growing up. The little boy that she lost to the state of California is actually the family that has stepped up to say they want Lily now. The little boy is 2.5 years old. When they adopted him, they did a closed adoption. They changed his name, and the family has never been a part of his life. No grandparents, no mothers, no father. They know nothing about him. They have been up to see Lily 2 times. So what I'm saying is when a child is placed at 2 days old, it's so important that DHS knows their policies and their laws, and so they're not leading somebody on for a whole year that you're going to get this child if there's not an approved study at 1 year old. I mean, you're just right in there. So, you know, everything was pulled from us. And We hired an attorney. Everything that we have done, I was told by DHS, because they all agree, all the attorneys, the CASAs, the caseworkers are like, you know, we agree with this, but we're hitting policy. There's this policy that is stopping us from letting you go to committee to be heard. Family trumps every time. And although they would love to see it go the other way for us, they're hitting policy. And they all have said that. And so just to try to bring this all together is this policy that the state is hitting every time is not in the best interest of the children. Lily is almost 20 months old. We are the only family she knows. She has brothers and sisters. She has stability. She's fully thriving in our home. She's confident. She's attached. And she knows who she is. She'll never grow up with a hole in her past thinking, who were my parents? Where did I come from? So I just think that it's so, so important when it comes to a little child, Lily, that each case is looked at from all aspects. And if there's a committee and only family is looked at, that she doesn't know them and they don't know her, why can't we come along and tell our side of the story? They tell their side of the story. Whoever, everybody comes together to let's like put it all out here and see what's best for this individual unique case and child, because this will affect the rest of her life.
Thank you so much for being willing to tell your story. It occurs to me that in Lily's eyes, you are her mom. I mean, you have done the work. You've loved her. You've nurtured her. You've taken care of her. I think the error of the policy that we have really undermines the whole idea of adoptive families altogether. It seems like it invalidates the idea that I'm an adoptive parent as well, that it invalidates the idea that our families are just as real as families that are built by biology. So it's hard to understand when you've raised a child how you can't be considered family when that's entirely the definition. So thanks for bringing your advocacy for your daughter to the state legislature. And I hope that we can work this bill and make sure that we're really putting kids first and honoring the fact that attachment comes from relationship, not from biology.
Thank you.
Are there other questions or comments? Senator Cruz.
Yeah. I understand the situation. There was a point in time when relatives weren't considered at all. Okay, and I think you're right, the pendulum has swung too far. An uncle in Texas, okay, I understand, you know, it has swung too far, and I hope we can get some balance here, but I mean, you are told at the very beginning when you're a foster parent that you're a foster parent. And then obviously at some point in time they're telling you other things that maybe were inappropriate for them to be saying, because until the determination's made, you're a foster parent. But I do agree that we may have swung to the point where all factors aren't being considered. So I do think this is appropriate that we take a hard look at this.
Senator Bonas-Anderson.
I forget which one of you, they have brothers, siblings in another state, yours. So is there anything in the policies that say that when they have siblings that you need to nurture those relationships?
Chair Gelser and Senator, I don't know how to pronounce your name, Moniz Anderson?
Moniz,
thank you. We do, I believe that the DHS will testify today as well, and also we have people coming up from Youth Rights Justice that can probably dig into a little more of the details of the current policy, and correct me if I'm wrong. I do believe that they do say, you know, that siblings, those relationships should be fostered. But to my understanding of Mrs. Lorditch's case is that it's, you know, it's a bloodline, and so therefore it trumps, you know, and that the idea of trying to get them together.
So it isn't that both families could still have the children.
Correct. And
I mean,
to
they'd have to be either or.
Right, and to Senator Cruz's statement a minute ago, and I will openly say, you look at that picture, and I've now been on both sides of this pendulum. I was able to adopt in that time when family wasn't considered very much. And that's what I really like about this bill is it puts in a significant amount of time, 12 months, and it also doesn't give preference. It gives equal status. And so it can at least actually be, you know, I feel like it's a really good balance of the two policies.
Can I just say one thing in regards to your question? I think that every circumstance needs to be looked at, and every family that, you know, after a year or family, why can't we all go to a committee and then everything's looked at in regards to what is best for her? So I really feel like, gosh, let's just lay it all out here and what is really best for her? Let's really find out what is best for her. And that's, I love her so much. I want what's best for her and where her family.
Thank you, Senator Olson.
I think the only thing missing from this bill is an emergency clause so that once it's passed, it goes into effect immediately so that we can try to bring things back together quickly.
Senator Olson Chair, is going
and
for
I don't
an
like emergency clause. I do not like them.
Chair Gelsinger and Senator Olson, I'm guessing, my guess is that the DHS, when they testify, will comment to that. The one, and in fairness of just legislation-wise, I mean, I've actually had a number of constituents reach out to me with this problem, and I'm not trying to change my own case through this. I do also have a sensitivity to and understand that there are some people, some families that have been told now for quite a bit of time, you are the only option. And so with my wife having been a caseworker, I'm also sensitive to that delicate balance of what you've told people. And that's one of the frustrations with Mrs. Lordich's case, what people have been told and then to go and practice something different. That's quite a challenge. But I'll let the experts, you know, fight over that final part.
Representative Stark, will this bill go into effect fast enough to help Lily and to keep her with her mother and her brothers and sisters and her father?
Chair Gelsinger, to my understanding, it would not. I'm hoping that there's a conversation. I've been told by a couple that have significant status at the DHS that there is a petition process that is normally allowed. I've not seen that that's been able to be practiced, and I'm hoping that that's a route that Ms. Lordich can go through. But the intent of this bill is not to change her case or my case, but rather just fix the policy problem.
Would you be open to an amendment in your bill that would look at circumstances like this one where there has been placement since, I mean, would you be open to investigating with DHS over the next couple of weeks something that would help these folks and help Lily?
Chair Gelsinger, and sitting next to you is Senator Olson, who is one of the chief sponsors on this bill. I'm a regular sponsor because I didn't want it to look too much like I was playing favorites on this bill. But I'm quite open to all kinds of things like that.
You're not the first, you know, family. I was campaigning a couple of years ago, knocked on a door, in exact same situation as yours, where the adoptive family, or it could have been adoptive or foster, had two of the siblings living in Eastern Oregon, and they did remove that child, and the child did go to Eastern Oregon to be with its siblings. So it's quite common that it is happening, so we need to have that conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both very much. Anything else before we let them go?
Well, I just was going to ask the question of Representative Stark. Do you think that if we did an emergency clause, so when this passed, it became law, and we'll talk to DHS about it, that it would help the young lady next to you?
I sure hope it would. And so I would love to see that. So,
thank you.
Thank you very much. Next we have Mark McKechnie and Joe Willard.
Thank you.
And Debbie Albright. And could we pull up a fourth chair and have Lynn Travis come up at the same time, too? Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. This is a hard act to follow. Thank you for hearing this bill. And I think at one point we had all but one of the sponsors of the bill in this room. I don't see Senator Shields right now. But I do want to thank Senator Shields and Senator Olson for being chief sponsors, and Senator Gelser, Mona Sanderson, and Representative Stark and Williamson for being sponsors as well.
Just say for the record, I wasn't asked, but that's all.
Ditto.
And for Senator Cruz, there's always a chance in the future. I think you've heard the reasons, some of the reasons why we brought this bill forward. We've seen many stories, like you've heard, in the 5 years, roughly since, four and a half, since the administrative rules changed, and I wanted to give you a little bit of background leading up to why we're here today. And Senator Cruz does deserve credit for helping us pass legislation in 2007 that created a requirement that DHS make diligent efforts to find relatives and to place children in foster care with their relatives, and also to place siblings together. A companion to that was a bill that eliminated a disparity in Oregon where relative foster parents didn't receive the same financial support that other foster parents did. And I don't see those changes at all in conflict with the changes we're talking about today. I believe that as has been noted, that the path that we ended up on was really an unintended consequence, where the pendulum had been so far to one side for so many years, where relatives weren't given fair consideration, either for fostering or adoption, that once we tried to bring the pendulum back to center, it continued swinging in the opposite direction, and now we need to bring it back to center again. As the first two witnesses noted, we also see this bill as focused first and foremost on the best interests of children. I think you've heard just a little bit, and you'll hear more, about how tragically complex these cases are and how many variables there can be and competing interests, where you're considering sibling relationships and parent-child relationships and foster parent-child relationships and grandparent-child relationships and aunt and uncle child relationships. But each case is different. And really what this bill is about is considering all of the good options and choosing the best ones. We believed at the time and continue to believe that DHS's administrative rule eliminated good options in some cases. We don't disagree at all that relatives should have serious consideration for adoption, but we don't think that should come at the exclusion of long-term foster parents. And as you've heard, this often comes up in scenarios for children who have been placed at birth or in infancy, who spend time in a home identifying their foster parents as mom and dad, believing, treating them, feeling that they are their parents, and then potentially disrupting that relationship. We would not say in all cases that it's wrong to disrupt that relationship, because there are many other factors as well. But what we're advocating for is considering all of those factors, having all of the factors out on the table, and then having the adults who have the tough job of making these decisions consider all those factors before reaching a decision, and not cutting off good options preemptively. I think the intent was to try to promote better decisions in some cases. Unfortunately, the consequence is to eliminate good decisions in some other cases. I think I was set up as an expert to try to answer some of your questions, and I will do my best. I do want to touch on a few of the technical aspects of the bill. I do think that some of your questions are better answered by DHS, but The heart of the bill is sections 5 through 7, and section 5 really directs DHS to change its administrative rule so that a current caretaker, which means a foster parent who's cared for a child for 12 months or longer, is considered alongside any relatives who come forward to be considered for adoption. It does not create a preference in the decision, the ultimate decision itself. It simply says that those two types of potential caregivers should be considered side by side when the interested candidates come forward. It would really be returning the rule to pretty much what it was before 2010. Sections 6 and 7 address some of the related issues to this, to the adoption preference, as well as the importance of recognizing and protecting long-term foster parent relationships. So what it requires, and we're currently talking to DHS about potential amendments to tweak the language, but ostensibly what this section, these sections do is require a report to the court when a child is moved from a placement they've been in for 12 months or longer, or a placement that's been designated by the agency as permanent foster care, and then for some reason they decide to move the child. And we have explicitly excluded the requirement if the move is to return the child home. So obviously, first and foremost, in these cases, especially at the beginning, the goal is to return children home, and we don't want to impede in any way the progress towards achieving that goal when it can be achieved. It's also important that once that report is made, a hearing occurs and the court hears evidence on why that decision was made, and it gives, the legislature would be giving the court the authority to essentially overrule DHS's decision and order the child be maintained in that placement or returned to that placement if they've already been moved, if the court finds it's in the child's best interests. So again, it's in, we believe, relatively rare circumstances, because this is a relatively small population we'd be talking about to begin with, where there's a significant controversy or disagreement about whether moving the child in that instance was the right move. We are investing the authority in a neutral fact finder, the court, to hear from all the parties and then make a decision on the best interests of the child. I'm glad to answer any questions, particularly any technical questions that you have that I'm probably better suited to answer, and we'll defer to DHS when necessary.
Well, why don't we complete the panel first and then come back to questions?
Hi, my name is Joel Willard. I was a little surprised at the reason I find myself here. I grew up in Oregon. I was actually born in Senator Cruz's district in Roseburg. I went to high school in Southern Oregon. Worked here in the legislative session in the 99 and 2001, and I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar. I work for one of the largest employers in the state, Intel, and so to find myself here as a foster parent and a father was a surprise to me. But I'm a board member at Youth Rights Justice, but I'm primarily here to share the story of my family and use it as an example of an adoption process that took place in another state, in California, and the process we followed here in Oregon, to highlight why I think this bill does two important things. First, it protects hard-earned attachment with long-term caregivers. And second, it expands the resources we consider as adoptive resources to include a category that is inherently valuable to the children. I was first certified in California. I lived in Contra Costa County as a concurrent caregiver, which means my wife and I were certified and welcomed to home in supporting reunification prior to termination, but knowing that we would be an adoptive resource if there was termination. That's a category that doesn't exist in Oregon, but our training and certification was aimed at and did a great job of explaining our role to really support connection with the birth family and be fully supportive of any reunification plan but identify children that were at a high risk for termination and place them in homes so that, it would minimize the number of moves they had towards adoption if termination occurred. It was in this role that my son Andrew, not to be outdone, I'm happy to share family photos. I was not prepared, so they're on my phone, but happy to bring this up so you can see the boys with permission that I'm discussing here.
Come on up.
Yep. All right. Let's see. Andrew's on the right there. Oh, I'm sorry. Andrew's on the right.
Did you crack that screen, Sandra Cruz?
When Andrew was placed with us, he was 8 months old. One of the things I wanted to share is you'll hear a lot of today, and you heard already from Representative Starr, the importance of attachment and that we're protecting attachment. The placement of a child, I believe my role when I was a foster caregiver and now as an adoptive parent, it was the same job. There's not this big divide between what I was doing when I had temporary care and when I was given permanent custody and was able to adopt my son. I am trying to overcome trauma, not just trauma from the abuse or neglect that caused a removal in the first place, or the report that caused removal while there's an investigation, but the trauma of removal itself. And I think what's important when we're talking about kids that are removed from their home is the hurt that's most towards the surface that you address first is a hurt of losing every person, thing, and place that brings comfort to that child. And the first hurt that I had to help heal and address, and we see echoes of it 3 years later, is the hurt of losing the only people that my eight-month-old son knew and could draw comfort from. And that attachment is hard-earned. Everything, I think, in those initial months and in that first year is earning the trust to overcome the trauma of removal. Now, removal is necessary. We know it's necessary. We're talking about hard choices in these cases. But I think that hearing, the first, when Mark was talking about the hearing that occurs if there's a placement change after a year, it's about protecting a hard-earned attachment with the current caregiver. And that's a decision, I think, important enough that court oversight and the court having a balance in the extreme measures when DHS has determined that a change is necessary is important. I want to go through a brief exercise where I ask you to imagine the biggest change you've made in your life. I looked up the five most stressful events that we go through: death, divorce, marriage, new babies, moving. Whatever that biggest change in your life was, really feel the panic and difficulty you had adjusting. Now, as an adult, we have that basis to overcome it. But you can latch on to that feeling that an eight-month-old might have with none of the background and benefit you've had of your experience to overcome it. And imagine it's everything that changed. We're not talking about a move to a new place or a new job or being fired from a job or experience the loss of a family, but a loss of everything that's familiar. And the importance of preserving and not doing that again when it's not necessary, I think, is paramount. I also wanted to share the story of a child who's currently in my home. He's in the picture as well. And in this circumstance, we'd moved to Oregon. We became certified for placement of a specific child because we learn of a biological relative of my son. And so this is another case of a sibling with a cross-state implication. He's placed with us now, and I think, again, another example of why family and foster parents need to be considered as resources. In this instance, we are the family, and so we're on kind of the flip side of that coin. We've seen those same difficulties in attachment and the same importance in preserving fewer change, but I think The second purpose of this bill and what we see and what's illustrated a bit by both the hearing I went to for my son and the current placement whom we are in place to adopt if reunification is not possible is that more options are better. Like family, one of the reasons we prefer family is they have the highest chance of overcoming and helping these children heal from the trauma that they've experienced. But long-term foster care have those same relationships and resources, and so they should be considered, and we need them at that same time. I think there are instances where family is going to be the right choice. I think there are instances where you're going to find that the place that child has been is the right choice. But just because it's a hard choice doesn't mean we should be eliminating some of the choices. We should really be looking on an individual basis. I'll end with one quick story from the adoption hearing I went to. I am an attorney. I appear in court, but appearing at the termination hearing for my son when he was in our care was a different experience, to be someone in the court that wasn't an advocate, but rather waiting to hear the determination. I was challenged when I walked in because it was a closed hearing, and I the attorney for the biological mother asked who I was and why I was there. When I identified myself, she then pulled out a letter, and I was expecting an opposition to the termination, and I really didn't know what to expect, but she said she was glad I was there because this was addressed to me, and then she read to the court, again, what I expected to be her grounds for why she wanted reunification and was opposing the termination. And what we got was a letter of thanks. Gratitude for Andrew's safety, for I think the obvious attachment that had occurred. And I bring that up because I do think there are circumstances where a family is going to feel pressure to adopt when they don't know there's another option. There are circumstances where a distant grandparent or aunt is going to feel relief that there's an option for a young child who's been in a consistent home. So once again, I think all those resources need to be considered, and that's why I ask you to support the bill.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Debbie Albright, and thank you for having me here today. I wanted to share a story about our foster son, and this was back when the pendulum swung, as I think we were the first case where it swung as far as it could possibly go. In the spring of 2009, an infant boy who we said had ears so big he could hear the sunrise, he entered our home, and we had been foster parents for a few years. He had been taken from his mother, who was arrested in the 7-Eleven parking lot for selling drugs. We were his third placement in a month. His needs were so great that the other foster families he was placed with could not take care of him. I have a degree in early childhood education and lots of connections with resources, and so we got him started with CDRC and EC Cares down in Lane County, and we fell in love with him instantly. He had visits with his mom at DHS. His mom was everything you would imagine a hardcore drug user to look like, basically from the after-school specials. She had the bleach blonde hair. She was as thin as a rail. She was dirty. After one particular visit, she came out of the visit with the baby, and she said, "I have something to give you." And she reached into her pocket, and I have to tell you, I was a little scared at what she might be pulling out of her pocket to give me, but she pulled out of her pocket a little stone that said nurture, and she said, "I love my son with all of my heart. Will you please nurture him and take care of him?" And I promised her that I would. Soon after he had been placed in our home, there was a paternity test done. His father had died of a heroin overdose prior to him coming into care. The paternal grandparents had asked for the paternity test in order to know if it was their grandchild or not. We started talking with that paternal grandparent and also the maternal grandparents, as well as siblings of the mother, and sending pictures and updates, and really developed a great relationship with them. We had adopted previously, and so I have an open relationship with my son's biological mom to this day. I feel really strongly that the more people in your life that can love you, the better. So we opened up our hearts and our homes. They lived on the East Coast, all of their family, but we had social media, we had email and phone conversations with all of the relatives as we were fostering this child. In October of 2009, his mother was arrested again and sentenced to a year at Coffee Creek, but because of time served, she was placed in the Lane County Jail, where she detoxed from a number of substances. And because of the state of the Lane County Jail, she was released from jail after 21 days, and 24 hours later, she was dead of a heroin overdose. When I received that call, my heart broke for this boy. he was an orphan, and I became his mother at that point because I had promised his mom that I would care for him, and I intended to do that. He was not an easy baby. He had a lot of challenges being drug affected. His mom had actually given birth to him at a friend's home as so that he wouldn't be taken at birth because of the extreme drug exposure that he had had. She received no prenatal care. So the bond, I think, the bond is always strong, but when you're caring for a child with those kind of significant needs, the bond is even stronger. We reached the point of current caretaker status, which was still happening then, and we were granted current caretaker status. And at that point, they started to look for relatives, the relatives that we'd all been in touch with, the paternal grandparents, the brothers and sisters. They really felt like he'd been with us for a year. He had the strong attachment with us, and that it was in his best interest for him to remain with the mom and the dad that he knew, with his brothers and sisters, with his, you know, the community that knew and loved this child. We had very open relationships with all of them, and they all wrote letters of support. They did find a relative, a second cousin in upstate New York, who wanted him. This was the cousin of the dad, and they had some pretty strong opinions about the mom, blamed her for the death of John, and but they decided that they wanted this boy as well. So we went to adoption committee up against this relative, and we were chosen unanimously by the adoption committee as his adopted placement, that we, in the best interest of this child, was him to stay with us, that we would be his adoptive placement. The relatives who had not met him before, who had 12 biological children of their own, 10 of them being under the age of 12, asked for a review of that committee. They said that they didn't realize that he had special needs and were not able to present how they would care for that. So they asked for a review of the committee. Unfortunately, that review of the committee happened after July 1st, when some of these administrative rules had come in to effect, and the new committee had a because at that point, relatives, blood, trumped all. And they gave their recommendations to Lois Day, who overturned our adoption committee. And within 2 weeks, the relatives came to get him. There was no transition. They came into town on a Friday and met him for an hour. They took him for the day on Saturday, and on Sunday morning they took him. I feel like this little boy, who was 18 months old at the time, I can only imagine that he felt abandoned, that strangers came and picked him up, and he never saw his family again. We were the only family he knew. The mom of this family said, "I just want to thank you for taking care of him until he could come to his real family. And you've been such a big part of his life." And my heart was just screaming, "I am his life. I am his mom. I'm not just a part of his life." And that was 5 years ago. My family has never fully recovered from that. The effects of it ran deep. And I think that's one thing that's not ever taken into consideration, is not only we'll never know how this affected our foster son, our son. He's 6 and a half now. We've never had contact with him since. They never extended anything to us. It's like a death of a child. You go home to an empty crib that you have to take down. There's an empty place in your car. There's an empty place at your table. And, of course, the empty place in your heart that never is repaired. I was happy when Mark asked me to come and speak today, just because this has been a long time coming to share this story. And I feel like family is not about biological. Family is whoever that child, if he could have identified us as his family, he would have, but he was 18 months old. I'm definitely in support of this bill that will bring this back so that family, foster families, and biological families can be considered and what is the best interest of the child, because in this case it was not in his best interest to go with strangers and to be one of then 13 children when he already had a home, a place that would have been able to celebrate both the life of his mom and his dad and all of his extended family. He wouldn't have had to have lost anything, but he did lose in the long run. So thank you.
Thank you, and I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you. Senator Gelser, committee members, my name is Lynn Travis, and I'm here in three different capacities. I'm the program director for CASA for Children, which provides volunteer advocates for children in foster care for Multnomah, Washington, and Columbia counties. I'm also here representing the Oregon CASA Network, which is a collaborative network of all the government and nonprofit agencies providing volunteer advocates for foster children across the state. I'm also here as a representative of the Permanency Coalition, which is a network of child-serving agencies as well as advocates who provide a range of services, including attorneys for children and parents in juvenile proceedings, CASAs, nonprofits who provide treatment services for children who are suffering from the effects of multiple moves and trauma and time in foster care, providers who do adoption recruitment and relative search and assist children in reuniting with families who may not even know that they are in foster care, as well as organizations who provide housing and support services for families who have adopted children from foster care. And all of those organizations support passage of Senate Bill 741 because we've all experienced stories like you've heard today, or have worked with individuals who have not had the opportunity to make the case for why children should have the benefit of a secure attachment. From my experience as the program director for CASA, as well as an attorney who has represented kids in the juvenile system for close to 30 years, these are not unusual stories. The decision that we have to make when children are going to be adopted is a tough one. It is not unusual at all to balance existing attachments with the advantages that come from being raised by kin and being part of an extended family network that you share biology with. That's a tough calculus, but it's one that should be made in every case where there is the option to look at both of those issues. The program that I work for represents...
And Lynn, I'm going to ask you to summarize just because I lost track of time listening to the parents, and we've still got two other bills.
Good bill. Pass this.
Okay, thank you.
I just want to add one thing. We have found that the court is a powerful advocate to tease out this information. There are some statutory provisions available now that allow the court to direct DHS to develop additional information about permanent planning that we have been able to use to help make the case or understand better which path makes the most sense for kids. The provisions in 741 that will add the opportunity for review and increased judicial authority will be a helpful complement to that I think will assist all the decision makers in making the best decision for these kids.
Thank you very much. Are there quick questions for this panel? Seeing them, thank you all very much. And we're going to lose Senator Cruz, so I need to temporarily recess Senate Bill 741, and we need to move to this possible reconsideration and work session really quickly, because we won't have everybody. So I am going to open up a possible reconsideration and work session on Senate Bill 296. Cheyenne, do you want to explain what we're doing?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 296 and correspondingly Senate Bill 490, the committee tried to correct a subsequent referral at the last meeting. The subsequent referral was supposed to be added to Senate Bill 490, which creates a task force. Instead, I gave the committee the wrong bill number. The subsequent referral was added to Senate Bill 296. So both are back on for reconsideration. To pull back 296 and remove the subsequent referral in error, to pull back 490 and add the subsequent referral.
All right.
Sounds perfectly logical.
Yes. So I opened a work session on Senate Bill 296. Senator Olson.
Chair Gelser, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 296.
Vice Chair Olson moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 296. This motion is not debatable. Is there any objection to the motion? If not, the rules are suspended.
Chair Gelser, I move we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 296 was sent to the floor with a do pass as amended recommendation and that a subsequent referral to Ways and Means was added.
Vice Chair Olson moves to reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 296 was sent to the floor with a do pass as amended recommendation and that a subsequent referral to Ways and Means was added. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. There is no reverse.
I don't have any more in the back.
Okay.
Chair Gelser, I move Senate Bill 296 as amended by the -3 amendments to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair also moves Senate Bill 296 as amended by the -3 amendments to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion carries. The bill is sent to the floor.
Wrong
thing. Gavel up my coffee. Which this is the, oh, we were sending this to Senator Cruz.
Okay.
Was going to carry this one when we first assigned it to him, and then we pulled it back. Great. All right, so I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 296 and open a work session on Senate Bill 490. Olson.
Chair Gelser, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 490.
Vice Chair Olson moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 490. The motion is not debatable. Is there objection to the motion? If not, the rules are suspended. Senator Olson.
Chair Gelser, I move we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 490 was sent to the floor with a do pass as amended recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves to reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 490 was sent to the floor with a do pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the motion? If not, the motion carries, and the measure is once again before the committee. Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Gelser, I move Senate Bill 490 as amended by the -1 amendments to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the measure be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 490 as amended to the -1 as amended by the -1 amendments to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the measure be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion carries, and the bill is sent to Ways and Means. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 490.
And my apologies again.
And mistakes happen. Thank you, Cheyenne, for catching it before we ran into trouble. And with that, I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 490 and going back to the public hearing on Senate Bill 741. And we have Kathy.
We can't do this without script. So when you see paper going back and forth.
Oh yeah, we can.
It said continued on the reverse. And I turned it around. There was
I've
nothing.
I've done this one before too.
We were lost.
This isn't the first time that we had to take things back to committee.
Timing good. Surprise doesn't happen more often. Welcome, Ms. Prouty. Thanks for
Thank
coming.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Prouty. I'm the Child Permanency Program Manager for the Department of Human Services Child Welfare Division, and I am here today to just briefly talk a little bit about Senate Bill 741. I think that it's very clear what this bill intends to do, and I won't repeat the testimony that you heard today. What I would like to do, however, is draw your attention to Section 6 of this bill. This section is a section that the Youth Rights and Justice in the Department, we've been having a number of conversations about an amendment to this section. And what we see this section doing is today judges can direct the department in terms of a level of placement, but cannot direct the department to place with a specific person. And Section 6 would change that, but it would only allow a judge to direct the department to place a child or maintain a child with a current caretaker. So we actually see Section 6 as giving the current caretaker foster parents a higher level of placement preference than the relative, because a judge would be able to direct the department to place or leave with a current caretaker, but with no other person. And I just want the committee to be aware of that section. We think that that would be a major policy shift that Oregon has not considered before. And once again, we are in conversations with YRJ about an amendment to that section. And those are the only comments that I wanted to make today.
And how close are you to having that amendment ready?
We've been passing back and forth some drafts, and I received another one before this meeting today. I have not had a chance to go over that amendment with my director. I have had a chance to go over the amendment with my legal counsel, which is the Department of Justice. We still have concerns about the language, so I don't think we're quite there yet.
I would like to move this bill next Tuesday. Would it be possible to get that amendment by the end of the week so that we can get the fiscals and get the bill moving forward?
That sounds very reasonable, Chair.
Thank you. And one other question. What do we need to do to help Lily and her family to stop her from being taken from her?
So, Chair Gelzer, I can't answer that question because I don't know where that case is in the process. So depending on what happens with this bill and depending on how quickly the changes occur and depending on where that case is, I'm not going to be able to answer that today.
And can someone from your department follow up directly with the family and Representative Stark about this petition process that they've heard about but that they have not yet been able
so
to access?
Chair Gelzer, let me clarify that. There is an exception in rule that a current caretaker can today be taken to committee alongside a relative. That exception request is not an exception that a foster parent makes. That's a request that the program manager of the county that handles the case makes, and that exception request comes to me and I make the final decision on that. So in the case of Ms. Lordich, it is the program manager in her county that decides whether to make that exception request or not. It's not the individual foster parent.
But given that you approve that response later, is that, since you ultimately have that authority, is that a conversation that you could have this afternoon with Ms. Lordich and start that process for that exception now that you've heard the circumstances of the case, since you ultimately have the authority to make that decision?
So, Chair Gelzer, I certainly can get involved in this case and find out the details of it.
Would you be willing to do that and maybe connect back with the committee by the end of the week and let us know how that's going?
Certainly.
Thank you
very
much.
How's your arm feel?
That's fine.
You know, this would be an exception. I know several families that are in the very same situation, and I don't know if we want to take precedent in something like this. So I know this is extremely emotional issue, and I support them because that family in my district, they took this beautiful little 18-month-old away. But it is a precedent, and I don't want to get involved in telling in a process that is really not our role. So I have concerns with us directing a department to make a decision a certain way or not, because we just don't have all the facts.
And Chair Gelzer, Senator Mona Sanderson, I appreciate those comments, and I didn't take it that this committee was directing the department to make a decision one way or another, but at least to take a look at this particular case.
Exactly.
And also, just to follow up, I think the issue is that what's been testified to is that there is a process, and for whatever reason that process hasn't been activated, but everybody's in the room, and this is the person that is in charge of that process. And to your constituents, I think figuring out why program directors aren't able to assist families to know how to make that request for these circumstances if they're coming up is important, because if there's a process to consider your constituent, Representative Stark's constituent, and others, it should be happening.
Further, have you, when you I remember us making this decision about relatives several years ago, and I want to know where the evidence-based research is on this type of thing, and I would like to have that information, because these are extremely emotional issues, and I know there's been research on this, and it would be nice to have that before the committee, before we start telling you what to do.
So, Chair Gelzer, Senator Montes-Anderson, there is some research, and I just want to say that for every loss that a family encounters, that's a gain for somebody else. And I think prior to the rules that we have today, you would have had just as many grandmas and grandpas and aunties and uncles sitting here and talking about the loss that they felt because their kith, their kin were not allowed to be raised in their family and were allowed to be raised by foster parents and feeling like their rights were violated. So these are very, very emotional decisions, and there is some research that we can provide to you, but I just wanted to say that we definitely understand that we often have two very good parties that love the child, want the child, and a very difficult decision has to be made in every case.
Thank you. And ultimately, just a quick question. You had mentioned kind of the heartache from the families, and I appreciate that. I think what I'm concerned about is going to the committee, what is the heartache of that child, and what is the experience of that child if they go to live with someone that's a blood relative that they have never met, and maybe their biological parents never met, and it's leaving the people that they've known for their whole life. So I just wonder how we create a policy that's really focused on the experience of that child. Sometimes I think a lot of our laws related to child welfare go back to a time when we thought of children as property that kind of moved through inheritance lines rather than as distinctly individual people that have their own emotional experiences and attachments that are separate from the people that they might be biologically related to.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Olson. Sorry.
You're close. What do you think about the emergency clause so we can get this in the action right away? What would your group feel about that?
Chair Gelzer, Senator Olson, I don't think we have a position on an emergency clause. We would definitely need some time to write rules, and we can put emergency temporary rules into place fairly quickly.
Thank you. This brings back when I first got here, we had a case of a little child that ended up going to Mexico to live with a parent, and it just surprises me that 5 years later I'm in the position to help fix some of these problems that occur. I never thought I would be, and it's kind of neat to be here. So, just my comment.
Sure.
Thank you.
That
any
it?
Further questions? Nope. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on Senate Bill 741? Hearing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 741 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 739. Cheyenne.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 739. Requires the Department of Corrections provide seriously mentally ill inmates with at least 5 hours of structured therapeutic activities daily and at least 2 hours of unstructured activities daily. Requires a cooling off period for seriously mentally ill inmates prior to non-emergency applications of force. Requires qualified mental health practitioners attempt to obtain inmate compliance during the cooling off period. Prohibits force likely to cause serious bodily injury with two exceptions. Prohibits use of chemicals except in an emergency. Prohibits isolated confinement. Directs Department of Corrections to adopt rules to implement and to provide for ongoing employee training, describes legal actions available to inmates.
Thank you. And we have there you are, Bob Jundiff, Sarah Radcliffe, and Joel Greenberg. And I am going to ask people to be relatively brief. We took a long time on that hearing, and we've got a lot of people for the next hearing too. Senator Shields brings meaty issues before us. All three bills are his today. And Senator Olson.
Thank you, Chair Gelzer, members of the committee. My name is Bob Junda from Disability Rights Oregon. I want to thank Senator Shields for bringing this meaty issue before you today. Disability Rights Oregon is a protection advocacy organization. We're federally mandated to protect the rights of people with disabilities in the state of Oregon. And part of that responsibility is to receive complaints of abuse or neglect of individuals who have disabilities and reside in facilities where they receive care, treatment, and custody. Those facilities include jails and prisons. And so for many years, we have worked with prisoners in various locations who have complained about conditions. And we've also worked proactively with the Department of Corrections and other and county authorities in order to respond to complaints of conditions in those facilities. We have had a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Corrections for over 10 years that allows us access to their facility to investigate complaints and respond to conditions problems. The most recently, we have received complaints that resulted in our conducting an investigation. This has to do with a behavioral health unit at the Oregon State Penitentiary. Some of you may have visited that unit. It has been a topic of conversation of the legislature in past sessions. Again, as was stated earlier, having to do with another bill, we are not here to criticize the Department of Corrections. What we are here to do is to inform you of the results of our investigation and why we feel that this bill would address some of the problems that we discovered. And so I will introduce to you Sarah Radcliffe and Joel Greenberg, who are both staff attorneys at Disability Rights Oregon, and tell you more about that investigation. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. I'm going to talk very briefly about what the investigation that we did conduct. In the spring of 2014, we received several complaints that alleged abuse and neglect of prisoners with serious mental illness in the Behavioral Health Unit, which is a unit of specialized housing at the Oregon State Penitentiary. You would need to understand why we did this. You would need to understand what the BHU is. It was originally designed to provide very intensive mental health services, support, and treatment to the most seriously mentally ill individuals in the prison system. These were people, prisoners, who, due to their mental illness, were not able to conform their behavior to prison rules. They were not responsive to the graduated system of punishments and privileges that are used to deter behavior, alter behavior elsewhere in the prison. And typically, they would cycle again and again through periods of punishment followed by acting out, exacerbation of symptoms, severe decompensation, and another cycle of punishment. And each part of the cycle reinforced the other, and some of these men had been through those circles many, many times. So we need, first of all, to commend the Oregon Department of Corrections for determining, understanding that this was not very productive for their staff. It exposed them to danger. And it was certainly very destructive for the prisoners who were going through these cycles. And because of that, they developed the Behavioral Health Unit. In any case, the complaints we received from prisoners, and we do get many, were very consistent and very concerning. And because of that, we determined that it was important to conduct an investigation. We did what we think is a very thorough one. We hope to publish a final report, which we will send to the committee within the next month or so. In order to complete this investigation, we interviewed prisoners. We interviewed almost 5,000 pages of medical and other records. And very importantly, we looked at videotapes of 7 cell extractions. These are instances of planned use of force where a prisoner is being forced to vacate a cell for various reasons. And the reason that those were important and that I'm mentioning them is that they allowed us to compare what we heard from admittedly very mentally ill individuals who had axes to grind in many instances, in every instance, with what we could actually see. And the videotapes were very revealing, and they convince us that despite the fact that the BHU was designed to help these individuals, over time, what has happened is that the unit no longer functions the way it used to, or at least the way it should. We've also corroborated to a great extent what the prisoners and videotapes told us by speaking to 9 former and current members of the clinical mental health staff who have either worked or are still working at the BHU. What our investigation revealed in very short order is that BHU prisoners spend months and sometimes years in a 6-by-10-foot cell. There is no natural light in the unit. There's no access to the outdoors or fresh air. The prisoners have very rare opportunities to speak with another person other than through a wall to the cellmate next door. They're all in individual cells. Most are in their cells for 23 hours a day. Very few of them shower or take recreation regularly, even though DOC policies require that they be offered those opportunities daily. With that brief picture of the investigation and sort of what the unit looked like to us, I'm going to hand this over to Sarah Radcliffe, who's going to try to put it in a little more human terms for you.
My name is Sarah Radcliffe. I'm also a staff attorney at Disability Rights Oregon. So in terms of the out-of-cell programming that's theoretically available to prisoners in the BHU, Joel mentioned showers and recreation. Our investigation revealed that very few prisoners reliably access showers and recreation. Theoretically, they're supposed to receive 1 hour per week of dialectical behavior therapy, and we were surprised to learn that this isn't a group in which prisoners are interacting with each other. In fact, they're lined up in cages about the size of a telephone booth for this programming. They're supposed to receive 1 hour a week with a mental health counselor. And for the few prisoners in this unit who've graduated to a level C, which is the highest privilege level that's available, they receive 1 hour per week in what's called day room. In my first interview with a prisoner, when I heard about this day room, I assumed that this was a room where they might have access to playing cards or puzzles or a punching bag, some kind of activities or programming. But in fact, that prisoner that I interviewed told me that it was just an opportunity to sit in a plastic chair in front of his cell rather than within his cell, and that's what it is. Other than these meager possibilities, the men in the BHU have literally nothing to do. Personal property such as books or radios, art materials, magazines, these are very tightly regulated. We reviewed emails from BHU leadership to officers apparently responding to concerns about whether a particular prisoner should be allowed to have a single crayon. Despite the BHU's original purpose of providing robust mental health treatment, our investigation revealed that in recent years, access to crisis and routine mental health care has dwindled. Former and current mental health staff complained to us that corrections staff dominate treatment team decisions and impede their access to their clients. Sometimes they impede that access through excuses and feet dragging. This process is universally referred to as slow playing, and sometimes by simply refusing to buzz them into the building. In the absence of mental health staff influence and presence, corrections officers respond to BHU prisoners' mental health needs with riot gear, tasers, pepper spray, and a restraint chair. We reviewed numerous incidents, both the incident reports and the video footage, in which there was no crisis counseling available to prevent self-harm. Once the self-harm occurred, usually swallowing a dangerous item or cutting oneself or banging one's head against the wall, the routine approach is to pepper spray or taser the prisoner, strip him, inject him, and place him in a restraint chair, often for long periods of time, and then to impose suicide precautions, which consist of putting the inmate back into the cell naked except for a suicide smock and taking away all personal belongings. Oftentimes, even the mattress is taken away. Mental health staff reported to us that they feel pressure from officers to impose these suicide precautions for punitive reasons rather than protective reasons. Medications are administered under the threat of tasering. We reviewed a video in which a prisoner was in his bed, wrapped in a blanket, and apparently deep in sleep. based on our interactions with this person and the reports of his neighbors, he seems to be sleeping or in a groggy state most of the time. On this occasion, he failed to respond to an order to submit to restraints to get his shot. And so officers, rather than assess whether he was being willfully noncompliant, simply tasered him in his bed to wake him up. Forcible cell extractions are also a regular occurrence. This level of violence causes lasting damage for the people on the receiving end, and it also creates a cycle of escalation and lashing out that exposes corrections officers to considerable risks. I think what really stood out to all of us that participated in the investigation was the level of self-harm in the behavioral health unit, and what we heard from prisoners and what we observed in the video footage and in medical records is eerily similar to what's seen across the country when prisoners with serious mental illness are kept in solitary confinement, and that is that they pace incessantly. They pound the walls, they mutter to themselves, they scream, and horrific levels of self-harm are a regular occurrence.
Thank you so much for bringing this issue.
And I'd like to turn it over to Joel Greenberg to tell a little bit further about how this bill can address some of these problems.
And I'm going to ask you to be really brief because we're about 15 minutes into your presentation and we have about 15 more people to hear from today.
Good afternoon again, Chair Gilson and committee members. I'm going to skip the history and just say that there's very good understanding and consensus amongst many kinds of organizations and government entities that solitary confinement is very, very destructive for both children and people with mental illness. The nuts and bolts of our bill, the key provisions that you would need to understand and that I think are important are that it moves prisoners who have serious mental illness out of their cells on a daily basis by requiring that they are essentially out for 7 hours a day, 5 hours of therapeutic activities, which frankly could be for us, even though we're saying therapeutic, it could be the opportunity to walk around and talk to another prisoner. It could be a job. It could be simply the opportunity to socialize, a class, legal research, almost anything. And 2 hours of unstructured activities, which would be showering and recreation, they would actually get those. The other key requirement of the bill is that for planned uses of force, this is not an emergency situation, but one in which a team is collected to take a prisoner out of his cell by force, use tasers and whatnot, that those are all preceded by a cooling off period in which a mental health professional, probably a master's level person, would be consulted, go to the cell and try to cool down, de-escalate the prisoner and see if there was a more peaceful way to resolve it. It doesn't take away the ability to use force when it's necessary, but it injects a stop sign and a roadblock to make sure that it's necessary. Other than that, we're happy to answer questions. That was as quick as I could make it.
That was very good. And I'm going to have us hold the question. Senator Shields is back, and I understand he needs to leave the building. So I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 739 and open temporarily a public hearing on Senate Bill 939. Thank you all very much. Senator Shields. And the refrain is we're asking people to be brief.
Yes.
Because you have brought us very complicated bills.
I know not to get in the way of a bill that is zooming towards Ways and Means, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate. Madam Chair, I wanted to thank you for hearing all of these important bills today. They're all critical to the well-being of Oregonians. I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 939 and particularly encouraging you to adopt the Dash 1 amendments, move it down to Ways and Means, because it's essentially an appropriations bill, but also has some important policy considerations that that you can decide on in the Dash 1 amendments. I became a fan of the Family Preservation Project back in 2009 when I was co-chair of the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means. When
Jessica Katz, the director, brought several graduates down here and was concerned that the program had lost its federal funding and were asking for help from us. And Representative Nolan at that time took an interest in it. Max Williams, at the head of DOC, said, yes, we will fund this with general fund dollars. And it went on for a number of years. The Department of Corrections has taken another look at the program and has decided with its lens, which is around recidivism, primarily focused just on recidivism, that it wasn't very cost effective compared to some of its other programming. Fine, I think that is a reasonable argument. But what we said is, this is more than just about reducing recidivism. It's also a child development program because no child is as at risk as a child whose mother or father is incarcerated. So we decided to pull together a work group that included DHS, Nancy Golden of the Department of Ed, and Lois Day of DHS. And they really came to the table along with Heidi Stewart of the Department of Corrections and a whole group of stakeholders that we've uploaded to OLIS or sent to you. I think it will probably be uploaded by tomorrow. And really tried to hammer out what components need to be in place for to improve services to the children of incarcerated parents. So that is what the Dash One Amendment is all about. And so I will leave it there because I think let the representative talk about the House perspective on it, and we'll let you get back to the rest of your hearing. And then there's a whole bunch of people, participants from the Family Preservation Project that would like to speak to.
Great. And that's why, Representative Vega Peterson, it's great to have you here. We are going to ask you to be brief because we have 30 minutes and two bills. We still have about 10 people left on the other bill before we get to this one.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the chance to testify. For the record, my name is Jessica Vega Peterson. I'm the state representative for House District 47 in East Portland. I'm also here in the capacity as a member of the Oregon Commission on Hispanic Affairs. I thank you for the opportunity to testify. So this bill deals with an important subject that doesn't always get much discussion when talking about our correctional system, which is the importance of fostering and maintaining strong relationships between incarcerated parents and their children. Senate Bill 933 creates much-needed programming for children of incarcerated parents and measures its effectiveness in terms that make sense for the nature of this type of programming, including school attendance, grade-level reading achievement, and developmental achievement for the children involved, and recidivism, release to stable housing, and increased child contact for the parents, in addition to the basic cost metrics. We know that these programs to assist children of incarcerated parents help reduce the likelihood of children being involved in child welfare, OYA, and even the correctional system itself in the future. These programs have a powerful and potentially long-lasting impact on families and can reduce the devastating legacy of intergenerational incarceration too many families live with. Senate Bill 933 provides a proven, powerful incentive for parents to turn their lives around. The Family Preservation Project was an effective Department of Corrections program that assisted children of incarcerated parents and reduced recidivism, as well as supporting the bonds between parents and their children. This bill would provide a fund, would fund a program similar to that, to be administered by a nonprofit to help reduce the costs, the overall program's costs. This change in administration also provides connection to the nonprofit resources in the local communities and Medicaid reimbursement. I urge your support of Senate Bill 939 as a means of interrupting the intergenerational cycle of criminal justice involvement, and in addition to serving the best interest of parents and their children. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative. So I'm now going to temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 939.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Return to the public hearing on Senate Bill 739. And next we've got Steve Robbins, Mike Gower, and Aaron Knott. And maybe we'll let Aaron go first. I apologize for keeping you here so long.
No problem, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice. We're neutral on Senate Bill 739, but in conversations prior to the hearing, felt it might be useful to come in and talk a little bit about just one brief portion of the bill that hasn't been mentioned yet, which is at the very, very end, which empowers inmates to press private causes of action for violation of any provision within this bill. And this generated a lot of chatter within the Department of Justice because this is already a population that generates a lot of litigation. So I think we could expect that this would be a dramatic expansion of the amount of litigation that this would create. All the more so because the definition of inmate with a serious mental illness includes, it's a quite a broad range, but it is including those who are experiencing presently or recently, and it includes things like substance-induced intoxication, other factors that are widespread within the population. Short form being, I think this for an estimates about what percentage of our prison population are suffering from some degree of intermittent or sustained mental illness varies, but it's consistently high. And this would provide many new avenues for civil litigation. And I, in the interest of time, I won't say much more except to say that there are already some avenues for litigation. Chapter 1983 provides a federal cause of action. Disability Rights Oregon has actually recently had success moving forward with some litigation around things like the use of restraint, solitary confinement by using that provision. So there are some remedies in law now, mostly just here to answer questions about fiscal impact. We don't have a number yet, but we anticipate it'll be significant.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Robbins. I'm the Health Services Administrator for the Oregon Department of Corrections. Very briefly, I'd like to begin this afternoon by providing you some context. Out of the 14,500 inmates that we have in custody, approximately 1,100 of them are classified as having a severe mental illness, or SMI. We're proud of the fact that 88% of that 1,100 live in our current general population. They have jobs. They're experiencing programming. And there's the 12%. They've got a proven track record of not being able to be with others, either through victimization issues, they're self-harming, or they're harming others. And dating back to a task force that occurred back in 2004, DOC's been working to improve the way that we work with this complex population. Over the past decade, we've implemented new types of mental health housing units to try and focus on crisis stabilization, work on tiered step down from crisis back into general population, and also for those that have demonstrated violence towards others. These units were all part of a process DOC was in that was on a glide path towards a purpose-built facility co-located with a state hospital in Junction City. Due to sentence reform in 2013, as well as the current inmate population forecast, Junction City is no longer a part of the 10-year plan. So the Department of Corrections is now retooling our approach so that we can meet the growing challenges within our existing resources. We believe that we are meeting our constitutional and legal mandate to provide care despite our limited resources, although we do want to continue to work with our partners in Disability Rights Oregon and able to accomplish that. I won't go through all of the concerns we have specifically based on time, but I did want to call out just a few of them. This bill would impose standards in statute beyond what we see in prisons typically and requires therapeutic treatment that is greater than even what the state hospital is working to provide right now. It's important to remember that we're not a mental health treatment facility that happens to have security. We are minimum, medium, and maximum security prisons that are trying to incorporate mental health treatment into our programming. And last, from a clinical operations perspective, this bill would require us to increase staffing to a level that we believe would be unattainable. Attempting to increase our qualified mental health professionals substantively while also having to hire clinical staff on nights and on weekends, remembering that we struggle to retain and recruit staff on day shifts now. Programming space to accommodate this exponential increase in individual and group treatment requirements, it's simply not available. It would require us to discontinue other types of programming in order to incorporate these. So while these, and as was mentioned before, while these inmates have a number of existing legal recourse options, this bill adds additional legal avenues for inmates to meet these new statutory requirements. So with that, I'd like to hand it off to Mike Gower.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, my name for the record is Michael Gower. I'm the Assistant Director for Operations for the Department of Corrections, so I oversee all the prisons. Some of the elements of this bill were spoken to earlier, so I want to talk about some of the operational impacts that would affect us. one of the ones that was brought up was the cooling off period. In the structure of the prisons, everything is time management. If we were to take a timeout waiting for a behavioral health specialist to come during a cool-down period, especially when they're not working or not available, that is time away that would they'd have to be supervised, that would take away from other operational issues. Obviously, that would impact us, and if that was to be the case, an additional staff would be warranted. The out-of-cell time, as they talk about 7 hours, two things that impact that. One is being out of the cells for the 7 hours would impact our operational space. A lot of these where our restrictive housing is located does not have the space for folks to be coming out, which means they have to be escorted to another part of the institution, which again would take security personnel, and it would probably interrupt or discontinue other operational programming. So if we had educational or A&D stuff needs, that might be impacted in reference to trying to meet the 7 hours. It would also impact the adults in custody, that it would signal them out to the other inmate population, which would bring them possibly being targeted for extortion or assault, because now they would be different than the other inmate population. You also saw one of the elements, which would be a concern for the same reason, not being able to use chemical agents. We would not be able to identify exactly who these inmates were, and we wouldn't want to put a tag on them to make them stand out to be any different. The 7 hours or the 5 hours of structured time does not include the possibility of work as it's written. So the inmates now that have work would have to either lose their jobs. For us, that would be twofold into the negative, one impacting our Measure 17 obligations, as well as not allowing the inmates to come up with some skill sets to reintegrate when they go back into society. We are happy to state that just recently we have been approved and will be working with the Vera Institute out of Washington for Safe Alternatives to Segregation Initiative. We're one of five states that was awarded this. They'll be coming out in May. They'll be looking at all our policies and procedures, and they're going to be coming out and visiting the six, what I say is the big six of our institutions, to do site visits, to give us some recommendations in reference to how we can manage this segregation population.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I am trying to figure out, you say you have 1,100 severely mentally ill in the prisons.
Chair Gelser, Senator Monsenders, that's correct.
So that means those 1,100 would need to have 5 hours of structured therapeutic activities every day, as well as 2 hours of unstructured activity every day.
Chair Gelser, Senator Monsenderson, that would be our understanding.
And what are other inmates? Do they have 7 hours, 5 hours of structured, and 2 hours of unstructured?
Right now, they have almost an hour a day for 5 days, and that would include coming out for showering and shaving and exercise.
So this population would, all 1,100 would be treated very differently than the normal.
Chair Gelser and Senator Monis Anderson, that'd be correct. In the restrictive housing areas, that'd be correct.
And how many of these, I think you said 12% or 125% actually have solitary confinement, is that correct?
Chair Gelser, Senator Monis-Anderson, that's correct. 88% of the 1,100 live in general population, and 12%, or approximately 125, are in restrictive housing.
This huge fiscal. Thank you.
So colleagues, I know there are other folks that are signed up to offer testimony. Cheryl Ramirez from the Association of Community Mental Health Programs, Jan Elfers from Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, and Kimberly McCullough from ACLU Oregon. I'm wondering if you could submit written testimony so that we can get to the next bill. I have talked to the principals, both the proponents and DOC. The bill isn't ready to move forward this session. It's
a very, very important, very, very important issue. The issues that are raised in the study are incredibly important, and what we've talked about is having all of you continue to meet. I understand you've started some conversations and meetings coming back before this committee to share the finalized report after Disability Rights Oregon completes its report, as well as the recommendations from the Vera Institute, looking at how we can move forward on something that's maybe a little bit more refined, manageable, to address an issue that's critically important, but also very complicated given the institutional setting that it takes place in. Is that amenable?
Yes, it is.
Great, thanks. And Bob nods from back there. And those of you that we didn't get to today, I apologize for that, but if you could send the testimony in, we'll get it into OLIS and make sure that we get to you when we talk about this again. It's April. We're at that time. So thank you all.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 739 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 939. I'm not going to move to Cheyenne because we already have the presentation by our good legislators. And we have a number of people that are signed up to support the bill that are regularly in the building. This is a bill that primarily will be determined in ways and means. So I'd like to start with the people that are here from out of the building. So Katrina Going, Christina Jinks, and Nova Sweet, please. And then Elizabeth and Mark and Donnie, you don't have to leave. If we get through this, we will come to you next.
Chair Gelsa, do you mind if I come up?
Are you Kivas?
Yes, I am.
Yes, welcome. Here. That's what I was trying to figure out. Who is Kiva? Welcome. I don't think
and
you
I
are always here.
Outside.
Yes.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kiva Miller, and I am an associate dean and professor and researcher at Portland State University School of Social Work. My role with this program is that I served as an evaluator for KM Research and Consulting. I have submitted my testimony, but I just want to briefly give you a little overview of my conclusions and recommendations. The conclusions from the evaluation report were that the Family Preservation Project clearly implemented services that were informed by the best practice literature, as evidenced by the overwhelmingly positive outcomes for the mothers, their children, and children's caregivers. The program's commitment to the individual needs of mothers, children, and caregivers, as well as the concerted effort to work comprehensively with the family systems, are deemed best practices for supporting successful reentry, fostering and maintaining parent-child bonds, and overall family well-being. I strongly recommended that FPP stakeholders continue to support the program and identify resources to expand intensive case management services to more women and their families. Unfortunately, that did not happen. And I would say any efforts to reallocate resources for a program that is similar in nature but not exactly the same would not be a good use of resources. The findings from my report are or highlights from my report I have submitted in my testimony, and I do believe Senator Shields will also provide my report for you all if you are interested in reading it. Thank you. I want to give them the opportunity to tell their stories.
Thank you very much. Welcome, and thanks for being so patient.
No problem. Who are you going to start first?
Do you want me to start?
Yeah.
Okay. So I have mixed emotions.
Can you start with your name?
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name's Nova Sweet, and I was in the Family Preservation Project at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. I paroled on February 26th. I had the opportunity to be in the program for 18 months. I have mixed emotions being here because part of me wants to say, why are we recreating the wheel when the program already is in existence? These women have been providing these services to mothers for over 10 years and have a relationship with the Department of Corrections that works. They understand the safety and security measures. They understand count times. They all understand all the nuances of the prison system, and it's unfortunate that the decision has been made to eliminate that program And now there's a bill that basically models that exact same program to start over. And in my opinion, that it's kind of taking a few steps backwards when it's already there. At the same time, we need something for all incarcerated parents, not just moms, because it's imperative that parents, that children stay connected to their parents, that the children don't have, there's already the stigma and all the chaos from your mom or your dad leaving you, and you're wondering if it's your fault or what's happened. So we definitely need something so that doesn't hurt our kids any longer. So I'm completely supportive of the bill on that level. I would love to see if there was a way to do both. And I don't even know if that's appropriate for here, but I want to say that there are there were 10 of us mothers with over, we represented over 20 children. And you guys have pictures, so that's from us. that when the program was decided to be ended, 3 of us since then have paroled. So there are still 7 women who make up several children that have no contact with their families in the sense of therapeutic visits, consistent phone calls every week. The being able to sit on your lap or crawl under a table or make lunch with your child, that's not in existence any longer. And there's 3 of those moms, which represent a child who's 2 years old, 4 years old, and 6 years old, that will not see their mother until she paroles. So it's imperative that we figure out something, and that whatever we figure out is not allowed to be terminated with 2 months to figure out how to say goodbye and how to cut your losses, because we're talking about children. It's just not okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Katrina Goins, chair and committee. One of the things I really want to...
Katrina, can you pull the microphone just not too close, but right about
One of the things that I really want to bring to is that, me too, I'm currently released from prison. I was actually considered one of their low risk, but I went to prison at 23 with a 6-year sentence. And I was not offered any type of rehabilitative classes or programming because I was a Measure 11. But when I got to the Family Preservation Project, they offered me that rehabilitation. You're taking one of the biggest things in that prison that actually works, that is shown to work, that has lots and lots of research and time, and has been shown to make a positive effect on our community and on the children that are in it. The biggest thing that I feel that we are losing focus of is our children. As a mother who was incarcerated, I take full responsibility of my actions, and now it is my turn and my chance to make sure that the children aren't being left out anymore, that their issues and their concerns and their hurts and wants are being just called to focus and being worked on. I really thank you guys for your time and your effort in hearing our things today.
Hello, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Christina Jenks, for the record, and I am here in support of Bill 939. I was recently released from Coffee Creek, March 11th, and I was a part of the Family Resource Center, which is a part of the FPP program. My youngest child's father was not, my youngest child's caregiver wasn't willing to bring my son to the facility, so I was offered to be a part of the preservation project, which I was able to stay in contact with my son and my 3 older children through, they let me mail out letters, and we did this once a week, and I also was able to make phone calls to the courts, because I was doing a modification for judgment to get parenting time back with my children. One of the barriers that I faced as a mother incarcerated was I was fortunate not to have a DHS case, but in that same sentence, I had no legal representation, so anything I did was on my own. The FPP program let me make phone calls to the courts. I was able to talk to the judge's staff and really let him know that I was serious about changing my life and reestablishing a relationship with my children. I believe that barriers in prison for people that don't have DHS cases are huge, because people are overwhelmed. They look at that packet that you get to fill it out, and people don't know where to begin. I was fortunate enough to work in the law library, and so I had more time than most to really get to know what I was getting into, and I still only, I don't know the depths, the whole depths of it, and I just know that the challenges I faced and many other people face in there, and it's not only with legal representation, it's about not knowing how to have those relationships with a child when you've destroyed so much out there. And a prison is a place to start over from if you take advantage of it, and I believe having programs like the Family Preservation Project or something like it in there for not only moms but for dads too, because there's dads in there that want to have a connection with their children and they're just not able to because the programs aren't there. And so I'm here in support of Bill 939, and thank you for your time.
Thank you all so much for coming today. I really appreciate it. Any questions? No? Thank you very much. You. So next we have Elizabeth Kushwa, Mark McKechnie, and I think it says Donnie from DHS.
Oh, Darren.
Darren? Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee, and thank you for your patience. My name is Elizabeth Kushwa. I'm the Strategic Director for Children First for Oregon, where we advocate for policies and programs that strengthen families and help keep kids healthy and safe. We are in support of Senate Bill 939, and especially thank Senator Shields' office for putting together a strong work group and a subgroup to really narrow down what looks to you like the Dash 1 amendment of the bill. There's written testimony that from our executive director on this, but just to recap quickly, there are over 7,500 inmates in the state who are parents. And as we at Children First prioritize vulnerable children, it's hard to underestimate the vulnerability of this particular population. We especially appreciate the fact that the bill explicitly states, the bill's explicit goal is to serve the best interests of the child, which you rarely get a chance to see. It has sub-goals and the important wraparound services to support those goals. Our concerns in the work group were addressed by including the trauma-informed piece of the training, recognizing the trauma that these families face, as well as including home visiting and parenting skills classes. This is very important. These are evidence-based programs. They have been proven to increase maternal child health. They have been proven to reduce childhood injury rates, increase school readiness. And in one particular nurse family partnership study, those families that experienced that home visiting with parenting classes, the mothers were twice as likely not to have another conviction, and their daughters were nine times less likely to have a conviction by the age of 19. We also very much appreciate that there are assessments built into this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon again, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, Mark McKechnie, Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. I know we're running short on time, so I will be brief as well. And frankly, I could have deferred to Elizabeth because she made a lot of great points. But we're here because this bill, Senate Bill 939, supports the best interests of children in a number of ways in maintaining parent-child attachment and bonds and relationships. I think that's become a theme of this hearing this afternoon, is how important relationships like that are, and it's better to preserve them than to try to recreate new ones for children. As Elizabeth noted, that preventing the eventual involvement in the criminal justice system of children of incarcerated parents is a critical goal. They're at very high risk of becoming involved in adulthood or even in adolescence, and we should do everything we can do to prevent that. It supports these children doing better in school by involving their parents in their education. It improves reentry services for people who are transitioning out of DOC, and has been mentioned, reduces recidivism. And I think the last point I would make that I don't think has been made yet is the cost of this program compared to the budget of the Department of Corrections, it's a drop in the bucket, yet the benefits are huge. It should be a no-brainer that we have programs like this in our correctional system to benefit both parents and children. Thank you.
Thank you both very much.
Question.
Senator Olson.
Could you explain
Since this is a gut and stuff, could you explain what the amendment does and how it's different than the first bill?
I think you're more involved than I was.
I would love to defer, Senator, to Amanda Hess from Senator Shields' office, if possible. The Dash 1 amendment is just makes it more explicit. There was language in the original bill that left wiggle room and didn't address things like the explicit amount of time to keep these attachments together, and the surfaces like transportation, the kind of a qualified mental health training that the Dash 1 amendment includes in the bill. Amanda, sorry.
Yeah, definitely. Hi, for the record, my name is Amanda Hess. I'm Chief of Staff for State Senator Chip Shields. And the Dash, Elizabeth had it spot on. It basically, she did a gut and stuff because she wanted to make it easier to see all in one, but it has a lot of the language of the original bill. But it adds in fleshes out the details that the work group went through about what are the specific goals of the program, making sure to outline number one, first and foremost, that the children's interest comes first when talking about these programs, and then out, you know, beyond recidivism, what are the other child development and attachment goals that are necessary. The Dash 1 should be on up on OLIS, and we have emailed the list of work group members who sat in the work group meetings of the last month to go over that language. And then I would say the last part of the amendment really talks about going through the work group, the operational issues of how you work through what the program looks like and what can be done by a nonprofit, what can be referred out, what space issues that, you know, these are all issues that we discussed in the work group.
And again, sorry to interrupt, Chair Gelser, Senator Olson. Part of what we got out of this is when we talked to the program participants where the gaps were as well. So that included helping to facilitate things like parent-child conferences. That is now explicitly listed in the bill. So this is it's a very thoughtful amendment.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for the school, Senator Mons Anderson?
Was DLC a part of this?
Yes. So Heidi is here in the back, and I don't remember your title.
I'm assistant director.
Thank you. Thank you. Heidi, the assistant director of DOC, sat in on every work group meeting, Elizabeth. I also can't remember her last name and title. But yes, DOC was at every work group meeting, along with DHS and OEIB.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you all very much. Did I miss anybody? I did not. It's 5 o'clock. I thought we were going to be here till 5:30. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 939. And just to review to make sure that we are on target here, we have carried over Senate Bill 659, awaiting a correction to an amendment. We have fixed our issues with Senate Bill 296 and Senate Bill 490. Senate Bill 739 is not coming back for a work session, but instead there's going to be a work group, and we will continue discussing that. That will come back to us. Senate Bill 741 is going to come back for a work session. Senate Bill 939 will come back for a work session. And we will be posting all of the agendas out. So as you see things that are posted with work sessions, we only have a couple of meetings left. So if you could kind of review that list and let me know where there's issues, concerns, or if there are amendments that you've requested, make sure that Cheyenne and I know so we can make the best use of time. We have a lot of bills come in late to this committee, so we're trying to work through all those right now.
Since we're running on, like, I would love for the Department of Corrections people to just stop by my office at some point in time, or even a phone call, because I have some specific questions.
Bring your handcuffs. Cuff her up.
Did you hear that, Senator Mons Anderson? All right. Anything else for the good of the order? Seeing none, thank you all very much for your attendance today. And we're adjourned.